her manner submissive. I was going to show her the photostat of my PI license, but I worried that it would seem brutal and coarse. I decided to hold off on that and whip it out if I had to turn the screws. Back in January, a woman brought a cat into the clinic for some kind of emergency treatment, and I want to find out if she ever came back to pick it up.
I can check our records if you like. Can you tell me the name, please?
Well, the woman's name was Elaine Bolt. The cat was Mingus. It would have been the night of January 9th. Two patches of mild pink appeared on her cheeks, and she licked her lips, staring at me fixedly. I wondered if she'd sold the cat to a vivisectionist. What happened? I asked. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Well, yes, I know which one. He was here for weeks, she said.
Her speech had taken on a nasal cast, coming out through her nostrils now as though by ventriloquist. She wasn't exactly whining, but it was the tone of voice I've heard kids use in department stores when their moms accuse them of misbehavior and threaten to jerk their arms off. It was clear she was feeling defensive about something, but I wasn't sure quite what. She reached for a small tin box and walked her fingers through a file of index cards. She pulled out the record, snapping it onto the countertop self-righteously.
She only paid 3 weeks' board and care, and she never responded to any of our postcards or calls. So in February, the doctor said we'd have to make other arrangements because our space is so limited.
She was really working herself into a snit here. Emily, I said patiently, is that your name or somebody else's tag?
It's Emily.
I really don't care where the cat is. I just need to know if the woman came back.
Oh, no, she didn't.
What happened to the cat? I'm just curious. She stared at me for a moment, her chin coming up. She brushed her hair back across her shoulder with a flip of her hand.
I adopted him. He's really a fabulous cat, and I just couldn't turn him over to the pound.
That's fine. Hey, that's great. I've heard he was terrific, and I'm glad you found a place for him. Enjoy. I will take your secret with me to the grave. If the woman shows up, though, would you let me know? I put my card on the counter. She read it and nodded without another word. Thanks. I went back to the office. I thought I'd better give Julia Oxner a call and tell her I'd located the cat, thus saving her an unnecessary canvas of Boca kennels and vets. I left my car in the parking lot out back and came up the rear stairs. When I reached my office, there was a man standing in the corridor, scribbling a message on a scrap of paper. Can I help you? I don't know. Are you Kinsey Milhone? His smile seemed superior and his attitude amused, as though he had a piece of information too precious to share. Yes. I'm Aubrey Danziger. It took me a second to compute the name. Beverly's husband? Right, he said, and then gave a little laugh in the back of his throat. So far, I didn't think either one of us had much cause for merriment. He was tall, maybe 6'2", with a smooth, thin face. He had very dark hair, lank, looking as if it would be silky to the touch, brown eyes, an arrogant mouth. He was wearing a pale gray three-piece suit. He looked like a riverboat gambler, a dandy, a swell, if such persons exist in this day and age. What can I do for you? I put my key in the lock, opened the door, and went in. He followed, surveying the premises with the sort of look that told me he was pricing the furniture, calculating my overhead, estimating my quarterly taxes, and wondering why his wife hadn't hired a high-class outfit. I sat down behind my desk and watched him while he took a seat and crossed his legs. Nice sharp crease in the pants, nice narrow ankle, Italian leather pumps with a narrow polished toe. I caught sight of his snow-white shirt cuff, his initials, A.N.D., in a pale blue monogram. Hand done, no doubt. He was smiling at me faintly, watching me watch him. He took a flat cigarette case out of his inside jacket pocket and extracted a slim black cigarette that he tamped on the case and then stuck in his mouth, flicking a lighter that shot out a jet of fire I thought might set his hair ablaze. He had elegant hands, and his fingernails were beautifully manicured, with clear polish on each tip. I confess I was sore amazed at the sight, amazed by the scent of him that was wafting across the desk at me. Probably one of those men's designer aftershaves called Rogue or Magnum. He studied the ember on his cigarette and then fixed me with a look. His eyes reminded me of hard clay, flat brown with no warmth and no energy. I didn't offer him coffee. I pushed the ashtray toward him as I'd done with his wife. The smoke from his cigarette smelled like a smothered campfire, and I knew it would linger long after he'd driven back to Los Angeles. "Beverly got your letter," he said. "She was upset. I thought maybe I should drive up here and have a chat." "Why didn't she come herself?" I said. "She can talk." That amused him. "Beverly doesn't care for scenes. She asked me to handle it for her." "I'm not crazy about scenes myself, but I don't see the problem here. She asked me to look for her sister. I'm doing that. She wanted to dictate the terms, and I decided I should work for someone else." "No, no, no. You misunderstand. She didn't want to terminate the relationship. She simply didn't want you to go to missing persons with it." But I disagreed with her, and I didn't think it was nice to take her money when I was ignoring her advice. I tried a noncommittal smile on him, swiveling slightly in my chair. "Was there something else?" I asked. I felt certain he was angling around for something. He didn't have to drive 90 miles for this. He shifted in his chair, trying a friendlier tone. "I can tell we've gotten off on the wrong foot here," he said. "I'd like to know what you found out about my sister-in-law. If I've pissed you off, I'd like to apologize. Oh, and you might be interested in this." He took a folded paper from his jacket pocket and passed it across the desk to me. For a moment I thought it was going to be an address or a telephone number, some scrap of information that might really help. It was a check for the $246.19 Beverly owed me. He made it seem like some kind of bribe, and I didn't like that. I took the money anyway. I knew the difference whether he did or not. "I sent Beverly a copy of my report 2 days ago. If you want to know what I've come up with, why not ask her?"
"I've read the report. I'd like to know what you've found out since then, if you're willing to share that."
"Well, I'm not. I don't mean to sound surly about this, but any information I have belongs to my current employer, and that's confidential. I'll tell you this much. I did go to the cops, and they're circulating a description of her, but that's only been a couple of days, and so far they haven't come up with anything. You want to answer a question for me?"
"Not really," he said, but he laughed.
I was beginning to realize that his manner was probably born of discomfort, so I plowed ahead anyway. "Beverly told me she hadn't seen her sister for 3 years, but a neighbor of Elaine's claims she was not only up here at Christmas, but the two had a knockdown drag-out fight. Is that true?"
"Well, yeah, probably."
His tone was softening, and he seemed less aloof. He took a final drag of his cigarette and pinched the ember loose from the end.
"To tell you the truth, I've been concerned that Beverly is somehow involved in this."
"How so?" He'd stopped looking at me now. He rolled the tag end of his cigarette between his fingers until nothing was left but a small pile of tobacco shreds and a scrap of black paper.
"She's got a drinking problem. She's had it for some time, though you'd probably never guess. She's one of those people who might not have a drink for 6 months, then, boom, she's off on a 3-day drunk. Sometimes a binge lasts longer than that. I think that's what happened in December."
He looked at me then, and most of the pomposity had dropped away. This was a man in pain.
"Do you know what they quarreled about?"
"I have a fair idea."
"Was it you?" I asked.
He focused on me suddenly, with the first real life in his eyes.
"What made you say that?"
The neighbor said they probably quarreled about a man. You were the only one I knew about. You want to buy me lunch?
We went to a cocktail lounge called Jay's just around the corner. It's very dark, with massive Art Deco booths in pale gray leather and black onyx tables that look like small freeform pools. The surface on them is so shiny you can almost see your reflection, like some kind of commercial for liquid dishwashing detergent. The walls are padded with gray suede, and the carpet underfoot is tricked out with matting so thick you feel as if you're walking on sand. The whole place comes close to a sensory deprivation tank, dim and hushed. But the drinks are huge, and the bartender puts together incredible hot pastrami sandwiches on rye. I can't afford the place myself, but it felt like the perfect setting for Aubrey Danziger. He looked like he could pay the tab.
"What sort of work do you do?" I asked when we were seated.
Before he could answer, the waitress appeared. I suggested two pastrami sandwiches and two martinis. That look of secret amusement returned to his face, but he agreed with a careless shrug. I didn't think he was accustomed to women ordering for him, but there didn't seem to be any harmful side effects. I felt like this was my show, and I wanted to work the lights. I knew we'd get blasted, but I thought it might take the high gloss off the man and humanize him some. When the waitress left, he answered my question.
"I don't work," he said. "I own things. I put together real estate syndicates. We buy land and put up office buildings and shopping malls, sometimes condominiums."
He paused as though he could have said a lot more, but had decided that much would suffice. He took out his cigarette case again and held it out to me. I declined, and he lit another slim black cigarette. He tilted his head.
"What did I do that pissed you off? That happens to me all the time."
The superior smile was back, but this time I didn't take offense. Maybe that's just the way his face worked.
"You seem arrogant, and you're way too slick," I said. "You keep smiling like you know something I don't." "I've had a lot of money for a long time, so I feel slick. Actually, it amuses me to think about a girl detective. That's half the reason I drove up here."
"What's the other half?" He hesitated, debating whether to say it. He took a long drag of his cigarette.
"I don't trust Beverly's account of what went on. She's devious and she manipulates. I like to double-check."
"Are you talking about her transactions with me or hers with Elaine?"
"Oh, I know about her transactions with Elaine. She can't stand Elaine. She also can't leave her alone. Have you ever hated anybody that way?"
I smiled slightly.
"Not recently. I guess I have in my day. It's like Bev has to know about Elaine, and if she hears something good, it pisses her off. And if she hears something bad, she's satisfied, but it's never enough."
"What was she doing up here at Christmas time?"
The martinis arrived, and Aubrey took a long sip of his before he answered. Mine was silky and cold, with that whisper of vermouth that makes me shudder automatically. I always eat the olive early because it blends so nicely with the taste of gin. He caught sight of the shiver.
"I can leave the room if you want to be alone with that."
I laughed. "I can't help it. I never drink these things, but Jesus Lord, what a rush. I can already feel the hangover forming." "Hell, it's Saturday. Take the day off. I didn't think I'd catch you in your office at all. I was going to leave you a note and then nose around, seeing if I could find out something about Elaine myself."
"I take it you're as puzzled as everybody else about where she might be."
He shook his head slightly. "I think she's dead. I think Bev killed her."
That got my attention at any rate.
"Why would she do that?"
Again, the long hesitation. He looked off across the room, checking the premises, doing some kind of mental arithmetic, as though in placing a dollar value on his surroundings, he'd know where he stood. His eyes slid back to me, and the smile hovered on his mouth.
"She found out I'd had an affair with Elaine. It was my own damn fault. The IRS is auditing my tax returns from 3 years back, and like a fool, I asked Beverly to dig up some canceled checks and credit card receipts. She figured out I'd been in Cozumel right at the same time Elaine went down there after Max died. I told her I was off on a business trip. Anyway, I got home from the office that day, and she flew at me in such a rage it's a wonder I got out alive. Of course she'd been drinking. Any excuse to sock down the sauce. She took a pair of kitchen shears and stabbed me right in the neck. Caught me right here, just above the collarbone. The only thing that saved me was my collar and tie, and maybe the fact that I have my shirts done with heavy starch.
He laughed, shaking his head uncomfortably at the recollection.
When that didn't work, she got me in the arm. 14 stitches. I bled all over the place. When she drinks, it's like Jekyll and Hyde. When she doesn't drink, she's not too bad. Bitchy and hard as nails, but she isn't nuts. How'd you get involved with Elaine? What was that about? Oh, hell, I don't know. It was stupid on my part. I guess I've had the hots for her for years. She's a beautiful woman. She does tend to be self-involved and self-indulgent, but that only made her harder to resist. Her husband had just died, and she was a mess. What started out as brotherly concern turned into unbridled lust, like something off the back of a paperback novel. I've strayed before, but never like that. I don't shit in my own post-toasties, as the old saying goes. This time I blew it. How long did it last? Until she disappeared. Bev isn't aware of that. I told her it was over after 6 weeks, and she bought it because that's what she wanted to believe.
And she found out about it this past Christmas?
He nodded and then caught the waitress' attention, glancing over at me. You ready for another one?
Sure. He held up 2 fingers like a victory sign, and the waitress moved over to the bar.
Yeah, she found out right about then. She tore into me and then jumped straight in the car and drove up here. I got a call through to Elaine to warn her so we could at least get our story straight, but I'm not really sure what was said between them. I didn't talk to her after that, and I never saw her again.
What did she say when you told her?
Well, she wasn't crazy about the idea that Bev knew, but there wasn't anything she could do about it. She said she'd handle it.
The martinis arrived, along with the sandwiches, and we stopped talking for a while in order to eat. He was opening up a whole new possibility, and I had a lot of questions to ask.
Chapter 17. What's your theory about what went on? I asked when we'd finished lunch.
I mean, as nearly as I can tell, Elaine was in Santa Teresa until the night of January 9th. That was a Monday. I've tracked her from her apartment to the airport, and I've got a witness who saw her get on the plane. I've got someone else who claims she arrived in Miami and drove up through Fort Lauderdale to Boca. Now, this person swears she was in Boca briefly and then took off again and was last heard from in Sarasota, where she's supposedly staying with friends. I have a hard time believing that last bit, but it's what I've been told. When could Beverly have killed her and where?
Maybe she followed her to Florida. She was off on one of her benders just after New Year's. She was gone for 10 days and came home a mess. I'd never seen her so bad. She wouldn't say a word about where she'd been or what had happened. I had a business deal I had to close in New York that week, so I got her settled and then I took off. I was out of town until the following Friday. She could have been anywhere while I was gone. Suppose she followed Elaine to Florida and killed her the first chance she had. She flies home afterward, and who's the wiser?
I can't believe you're serious, I said. Do you have any evidence? Do you have anything that links Beverly even superficially with Elaine's disappearance?
He shook his head. Look, I know I'm fishing here, and I could be completely off base. I hope like hell I am. I probably shouldn't have said anything.
I could feel myself getting restless, trying to make sense of what he had said. Why would Beverly have hired me if she'd killed Elaine?
Maybe she wanted to make it look good. The business about the cousin's estate was legitimate. The notice arrives in the mail, and now what's she going to do? Suppose she knows Elaine is strolling along the bottom of the ocean in a pair of concrete shoes. She has to go through the motions, doesn't she? She can't ignore the situation because somebody's going to wonder why she doesn't show more concern. So she drives up here and hires you.
I looked at him skeptically. Only then she panics when I say I'm going to the police.
Right. And then she figures she better cover for that, so she talks to me.
I finished my martini, thinking about what he'd said. It was very elaborate, and I didn't like that. Still, I had to concede that it was possible. I made concentric circles on the tabletop with the bottom of my glass. I was thinking about the break-in at Tilly's place.
Where was she Wednesday night?
He drew a blank.
I don't know. What do you mean?
I'm wondering where she was Wednesday night and early Thursday morning of this week. Was she with you? He frowned.
No. I flew to Atlanta Monday night and came back yesterday. What's the deal?
I thought I should keep the details to myself for the time being. I shrugged.
There was an incident up here. Did you call her from Atlanta on either of those days?
I didn't call her at all.
We used to do that when I was off on business trips, talk back and forth long distance. Now it's a relief to be away.
He took a sip of his drink, watching me above the rim of the glass.
You don't believe any of this, do you?
It doesn't make any difference what I believe, I said. I'm trying to find out what's true. So far, it's all speculation. He shook his head.
I know I don't have any concrete proof, but I felt like I had to tell someone. It's been bugging the shit out of me.
I'll tell you what's bugging me, I said. How can you live with someone you suspect of murder?
He stared down at the table for a moment, and the smile, when it came, was tainted with the old arrogance.
I thought he was going to answer me, but the silence stretched, and finally he simply lit another cigarette and signaled for the check. I called Jonah in the middle of the afternoon. The encounter with Aubrey Danziger had depressed me, and the two martinis at lunch had left me with a nagging pain between the eyes. I needed air and sunshine and activity.
You want to go up to the firing range and shoot? I said when Jonah got on the line. Where are you?
I'm at the office, but I'm on my way home to pick up some ammo.
Swing by and pick me up, too, he said.
I smiled when I hung up the phone.
Good.
The clouds hung above the mountains like puffs of white smoke left in the wake of a giant old-fashioned choo-choo train. We took the old road up through the pass, my VW making high-pitched complaints until I shifted from third gear to second and finally into first. The road twisted up through sage and mountain lilac. As we approached, the dark green of the distant vegetation separated into discrete shrubs, clinging obstinately to the slopes. There were very few trees. Steep expanses of California buckwheat were visible on the right, interspersed with the bright little orange faces of monkey flower and the hot pink of prickly phlox. The poison oak was thriving, its lush growth almost overwhelming the silvery leaves of the mugwort, which grew alongside it and is its antidote. As we reached the summit, I glanced to my left. The elevation here was about 2,500 feet, and the ocean seemed to hover in the distance like a gray haze blending into the gray of the sky. The coastline stretched as far as the eye could see, and the town of Santa Teresa looked as insubstantial as an aerial photo. From this perspective, the mountain ridge seemed to plunge into the Pacific, appearing again in four rugged peaks that formed the offshore islands. The sun up here was hot, and the volatile oils, exuded by the underbrush, scented the still air with camphor. There were occasional manzanita trees along the slope, still stripped down to spare, misshapen black forms by the fire that had swept through 2 years back. Everything that grows up here longs to burn. Seed coats broken only by intense heat, germinating then when the rains come again. It's not a cycle that concedes much to human intervention. The narrow road to the firing range veered off to the left, just at the mountain's crest. climbing at an angle through huge sandstone boulders that looked as light and fake as a movie set. I pulled into the dirt and gravel parking area, and Jonah and I got out of the car, taking guns and ammo from the back seat. I don't think we'd exchanged 6 words the entire 30-minute trip, but the silence was restful. We paid our fees and tucked little wads of foam in our ears to muffle the sound. I had also brought along a headset, like earmuffs, for additional protection. My hearing had already sustained some damage that I was hoping wasn't going to be permanent. With the plugs in place, I could hear the air going in and out of my nose, a phenomenon I didn't pay much attention to ordinarily. I liked the quiet. At the core of it, I could hear my own heart, like someone thumping on a plaster wall 2 floors below. We moved up to the range, roof overhead like a carport extending 15 feet on either side of us. Only one man was shooting, and he had an H&K 45 competition pistol that Jonah coveted the minute he laid eyes on it. The two of them talked about the adjustable trigger and adjustable sights while I inserted 8 rounds of reloads into the magazine of my little gun. I inherited this no-brand semi-automatic from the very proper maiden aunt who raised me after my parents died. She taught me to knit and crochet when I was 6, and when I was 8, she'd brought me up here and taught me to target shoot, bracing my arms on a wooden ironing board that she kept in the trunk of her car. I had fallen in love with the smell of gunpowder when I first came to live with her. I'd sit out on her concrete porch steps with a strip of caps and a hammer, patiently banging away until each snapped out its load of perfume. The porch steps would be littered afterward with bits of red paper and gray spots of burned powder the size of the buckle holes in a belt. I guess she decided after 2 years of my incessant hammering that she might as well school me in the real thing. Jonah had brought both his Colts, and I fired a few rounds from each, but they felt like too much gun for me. The walnut grip on the trooper handled like a big hunk of petrified wood, and the 4-inch barrel made sighting a bitch. The gun bucked in my hand like that quick automatic kick when a doctor taps on your knee, and each time the gun bucked, a whiff of gunpowder blew back at me. I did slightly better with the Python, but it was still a distinct and familiar treat when I took up my 32 again, like holding hands with an old friend. At 5, we packed up our gear and headed over to the old Stagecoach Tavern, tucked into a shady hollow not far from the range. We had beer and bread and baked beans, and talked about nothing in particular. "How's your case going?" he asked me. "You turned up anything yet?" I shook my head. "I've got some things I may want to talk to you about at some point, but not for now." "You sound bummed out," he said. I smiled. "I always do this to myself. I want quick results. If I don't get things wrapped up in 2 days, I get depressed." "What about you? Are you okay?" He shrugged. "I miss my kids. I used to spend Saturdays with them. It was nice you called. Gave me something to do besides mope." "Yeah, you can watch me mope," I said. He patted my hand on the table and squeezed it lightly. The gesture was brief and compassionate, and I squeezed back. I dropped him off at his place again at 7:30 or so, and went home. I was tired of worrying about Elaine Bolt, so I sat on the couch and cleaned my gun, taking in the smell of oil, finding it restful to dismantle and wipe and put it all back together again. After that, I stripped my clothes off and wrapped up in my quilt, reading a book about fingerprint mechanics until I fell asleep. Monday morning I stopped by Santa Teresa Travel on my way into the office and talked to an agent named Lupe, who looked like an interesting mix of Chicano and black, slim as a cat. She was in her 20s, with tawny skin and dark frizzy hair with a faint golden cast, cut close to the shape of her head. She wore small rectangular glasses and a smart navy blue pantsuit with a striped tie. I showed her the ticket carbon and told her what I was looking for. My guess was correct. Elaine had been a regular client of theirs for the past several years, though Lupe seemed puzzled by the carbon. She pulled the glasses down low on her nose and looked at me. Her eyes were a flat gold like a lemur's, and it gave her face an exotic quality. puffy mouth, small straight nose. She had fingernails that were long and curved and looked as tough as horn. Maybe she had been some kind of burrowing creature in another life. She pushed the glasses back into place again, thoughtfully.
"Well, I don't know what to think," she said. "She always bought her tickets through us, but this one was purchased at the airport."
She touched at one corner of the carbon, turning the ticket around so I could see the face of it. It reminded me of those teachers in grade school who somehow managed to read a picture book while holding it forward and to one side.
"These numbers indicate that it was generated by the airline and paid for by credit card."
"What kind of credit card?"
"American Express. She usually uses that for travel, but I tell you what's odd. She'd made reservations for... Wait a minute, let me check."
Lupe typed some numbers into her computer terminal, nails tap dancing across the keys. The computer fired out line after line of green print-like tracers. She studied the screen.
"She was scheduled to fly out of LAX first class on February 3rd, with a return 3 August, and those tickets were paid for."
"I hear she left on the spur of the moment," I said. "If she set up the reservations over the weekend, she'd have had to go through the airlines, wouldn't she?"
"Sure, but she wouldn't just forget about the tickets she had. Hold on a sec, and I'll see if she ever picked them up. She could have traded them in."
She got up and moved over to the file cabinet on the far wall, sorting through her files. She pulled out a packet and handed it to me. It was a set of tickets and an itinerary, tucked into a travel folder from the agency. Elaine's name was neatly typed across the front.
"That's $1,000 worth of tickets," Lupe said.
"You'd think she'd have called us and had them cashed in when she got to Boca." I felt a chill.
"I'm not sure she got there," I said.
I sat for a full minute with the unused tickets in my hand. What was this? I reached into my purse and pulled out the original TWA folder Julia Oxner had mailed to me. On the back flap, there were the 4 luggage tags sequentially numbered and still stapled firmly in place. Lupe was watching me. I was thinking about my own quick flight to Miami, getting off the plane at 4:45 in the morning, passing the glass-fronted cases where abandoned suitcases were stacked.
"I want you to call Miami International for me," I said slowly. "Let's put in a claim for lost baggage and see if we come up with anything."
"You lost some bags?"
"Yeah, 4 of them. Red leather with gray fabric bindings. Hard-sided, graduated sizes, and my guess is that one is a hanging bag. These are the tags for them."
I pushed the folder across the desk, and she wrote the numbers down. I gave her my business card, and she said she'd be in touch as soon as she heard anything.
"One more question," I said. "Was that flight she took nonstop?"
Lupe glanced at the carbon and shook her head.
"That's the red eye. She'd have had a layover and a change of planes in St. Louis."
"Thanks." When I got to the office, the message light on my answering machine was blinking. I pressed the playback button. It was my punker friend, Mike.
"Hey, Kinsey?" "Oh, shit, a machine. Well, never mind. I'll call you back, okay? Oh, this is Mike, and there's just something I want to talk to you about, but I have a class right now. Anyway, I'll call back later, okay? Bye."
I made a note. The timer on the machine indicated that he'd called at 7:42 a.m. Maybe he'd try again at noon. I wished he'd left me a number. I put in a call to Jonah and told him about Elaine's stopover.
"Could you circulate a description of her through the St. Louis police?"
"Sure. You think that's where she is?"
"I hope."
I intended to sit and chat with him, but I didn't have the chance. There was a quick knock, and my office door flew open. Beverly Danziger stood on the threshold, and she looked pissed off. I told Jonah I'd get back to him and hung up, turning my attention to Beverly.
Chapter 18.
"You goddamn bitch!"
She slammed the door behind her, eyes flashing. I'm not real fond of being addressed like that. I could feel the heat rise in my cheeks, my temper climbing automatically.
I wondered if she was going to challenge me to hand-to-hand combat. I gave her a slow smile just to show her I wasn't impressed with the histrionics.
"What's the problem, Beverly?"
I sounded like a smart aleck even to myself, and I thought I'd better cast about for something to smite her with if she came flying across the desk at me. All I spotted was an unsharpened pencil and a Rolodex. She put her hands on her hips.
"What the fuck did you contact Aubrey for? How dare you? How fucking dare you?"
"I didn't contact Aubrey. He got in touch with me."
"I hired you. I did. You had no right to talk to him and no right to discuss my business behind my own back. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sue you for this."
I wasn't worried she'd sue me. I was worried she'd pull a pair of scissors out of her purse and cut me up like patches for a quilt. By now she was leaning over my desk, stabbing a pointed index finger into my face. Shout lines appeared to come out of her mouth as in a cartoon. She thrust her chin forward, cheeks pink, bubbles collecting in the corner of her mouth. I wanted to slap the shit out of her, but I didn't think it'd be smart. She was beginning to hyperventilate, chest heaving. And then her mouth began to tremble, and the fiery blue eyes filled with tears. She sobbed once. She dropped her handbag and put both hands to her face like a little kid. Was this woman nuts or what?
"Sit down," I said. "Have a cigarette. What's going on?"
I glanced down at the ashtray. Aubrey's telltale pile of shredded tobacco and a scrap of black paper were still sitting in my ashtray. Discreetly, I removed it, tipping the contents into my trash. She sat down abruptly, her anger gone, some deep-seated grief having taken its place. I'm sorry to report myself unmoved. I can be a cold-hearted little thing. While she wept, I made coffee. My office door opened a crack, and Vera peeked in, making eye contact. She'd apparently heard the ruckus and wanted to make sure I was all right. I lifted my eyebrows in a quick facial shrug, and she disappeared. Beverly fished out a Kleenex and pinched it across the bridge of her nose, pressing her eyes as though to extract the last few tears. Her porcelain complexion was now mottled, and her glossy black hair had taken on a stringy look, like a fur muff left out in the rain.
"I'm sorry," she breathed. "I know I shouldn't have done that. He's making me crazy. He's driving me absolutely insane. He's such a son of a bitch. I just hate his guts."
"Take it easy, Beverly. You want some coffee?"
She nodded. She got a compact out of her bag and checked her eye makeup, mopping up a run of mascara with Kleenex folded over her finger. Then she tucked the compact away and blew her nose without making a sound. It was just a sort of squeezing process. She opened her bag again and searched for her cigarettes and matches. Her hands were shaking, but the minute she got her cigarette lighted, all the tension seemed to leave her body. She inhaled deeply as though she were taking in ether before surgery. I wish cigarettes felt that good to me. Every time I've had a drag, my mouth has tasted like a cross between charred sticks and spoiled eggs. It's made my breath smell about that good, too, I'm sure. My office was now looking like the fog had rolled in. She began to shake her head hopelessly.
"You have no idea what I've been through," she said.
"Look," I said, just to set the record straight.
"I know you didn't do anything. It's not your fault."
Her eyes filled with tears briefly.
"I should be used to it by now, I guess."
"Used to what?"
She began to fold the Kleenex in her lap. She recited slowly, fighting for control, sentences punctuated with silences and little humming noises when the weeping closed off her throat.
"He, goes around to people, and he tells them, that I drink. And sometimes he claims I'm a nymphomaniac, or he says I'm undergoing shock treatments. Whatever occurs to him, whatever he thinks will do the most harm."
I wasn't sure what to do with this. He had told me she was an alcoholic. He told me she went off on 3-day toots. He told me she attacked him with a pair of scissors and had possibly murdered her sister in revenge for an affair he was having with her. Now here she sat, sobbing her tiny heart out, claiming that he was the perpetrator of this weird pathological stuff. Which of them was I to believe? She composed herself, giving her nose the old silent squeeze. She looked at me, the whites of her eyes now tinted with pink.
"Didn't he tell you something like that?" she asked.
"I think he was just concerned about Elaine," I said, trying to hedge until I could decide what to do. "We really didn't discuss anything personal, so don't worry about that. How did you find out he'd been up here?"
"Something came up in conversation," she said. "I don't even remember what. That's how he handles these things. He gives me these clues. He leaves the evidence around and waits for me to discover it. And if I don't stumble across it accidentally, he points me right to it, and then sits back and pretends to be contrite and amazed."
I was just about to say, like his affair with Elaine, but it suddenly occurred to me that it might not even be true, or if true, that she might not actually know about it. "Like what, for example?" I said.
"He had an affair with Elaine. He was fucking around with my only sister. God, I can't believe he did that to me. I didn't doubt she'd do it. She was always jealous. She'd take anything she could. But him, I felt like such a fool. He was off bawling her the minute Max died, and I was such a dunce I didn't figure it out for years. It took me years."
She did one of those bubbling laughs, filled more with hysteria than mirth. "Poor Aubrey, he must have been at his wit's end trying to get me to pick up on that. He finally cooked up this absurd tale about the IRS auditing his taxes. I told him the accountant could take care of it, but he said Harvey wanted us to go through the canceled checks and credit card receipts. So like a dodo, I did it, and there it was." "Why don't you leave?" I asked. "I don't understand why you stay in a relationship like that." "I always say the same thing. Every time I hear a tale like this, drunkenness, beatings, infidelity, and verbal abuse, I just don't get it. Why do people put up with it?" I had said it to Aubrey, so I figured I might as well say it to her, too. The marriage was a mess, and regardless of where the truth lay, these two people were miserable. Was misery the point?
End of Disc 5. Disc 6.
The marriage was a mess, and regardless of where the truth lay, these two people were miserable. Was misery the point?
"Oh, I don't know. Part of it's the money, I guess," she said.
"Screw the money. This is a community property state."
"That's what I mean," she said. "He'll walk away with half of everything I have, and it just seems so unfair."
I looked at her blankly. "The money's yours?"
"Well, of course it's mine," she said, and then her expression changed. "He told you it was his, didn't he?"
I shrugged uncomfortably. "More or less. He told me he put together real estate syndicates." She was startled for an instant, and then she laughed. She started to cough, patting her chest. She stubbed out her cigarette, pecking it in the bottom of the ashtray. Smoke was streaming out of her nostrils as though her brain had caught fire. She was shaking her head, smiling faintly.
"Sorry, but that's a new one on me. I should have guessed. What else did he say?"
I held up a hand in protest. "Hey," I said, "enough. I don't want to play this game. I don't know what your problems are, and I don't care."
"You're right, you're right. God, we must seem like lunatics to you. I'm sorry you got sucked in. It's not your concern, it's mine. How much do I owe you for your time?"
She was rooting through her handbag for her checkbook and her famous rosewood pen and pencil set. I could feel my temper on the rise again. "I don't want any money from you. Don't be absurd. Why don't you give me some straight answers for a change?" She blinked at me, the china blue eyes glazing over like ice on a pond.
"About what?"
"Elaine's neighbor claims you were up here at Christmas and the two of you had a big fight. You told me you hadn't seen her for years. Now which is it?" She stalled, reaching for another cigarette so she'd have time to frame a reply. I headed her off. "Come on, Beverly, just tell me the truth. Were you up here or not?" She took out a packet of matches and removed a match, scratching it repeatedly across the packet without effect. She tossed that one, a dud apparently, into the ashtray and took out a second match. This time she managed to light her cigarette.
I did come up, she said carefully.
She tapped the lighted cigarette on the lip of the ashtray, as though to remove an ash, when there was none yet. I was going to scream if she did any more shit with that cigarette.
Did you quarrel with her or didn't you?
She switched to her officious tone, mouth going all prim.
Kinsey, I had just found out about the affair. Of course we quarreled. That's exactly what Aubrey had in mind, I'm sure. What would you have done?
What difference does it make? I'm not married to him, so who gives a damn what I'd have done? I want to know why you lied to me. She stared at the desk, her face taking on a stubborn look. I tried another tack. Why'd you call me off? Why wouldn't you let me contact the police?
She smoked for a moment, and I thought at first she didn't intend to answer that question either. I was worried he'd done something.
I stared at her. She caught my look and leaned forward earnestly.
He's crazy. He is a truly crazy man, and I was worried that he'd... I don't know. I suppose I was worried he'd killed her.
All the more reason to call the police, isn't it?
You don't understand. I couldn't turn the police loose on this. That's why I hired you in the first place. When this whole business came up about the will, I didn't think anything of it. It was such a minor matter. I just assumed she'd signed the paper and sent it to the attorney. And then when I realized no one had heard from her, it occurred to me that something might be wrong. I don't even know what I thought it was.
But when I mentioned she might be dead, the penny dropped, right? I sounded bored. I sounded contemptuous, too. She shifted uncomfortably.
Before that, I guess I'd just never really put it in words until you said it, and then I realized I'd better reassess the situation before I agreed to anything.
What makes you think Aubrey's involved?
That day, when I drove up here and Elaine and I had words, she told me then that the affair had been going on for years. She'd finally figured out that Aubrey was a psychopath and she was trying to break it off.
She paused and the blue eyes came up to mine.
You don't understand about Aubrey yet. You don't know what he's like. You just don't leave him. You just don't break it off. I've threatened to do that myself. Don't think it hasn't occurred to me. But I'd never make it. I don't know what he'd do, but I'd never get away from him. Never. He'd follow me to the ends of the earth and bring me back. Only then he'd really make me pay.
Bev, I've got to tell you, I'm having trouble with this, I said.
That's because you fell for it. He came waltzing up here and he laid a number on you. He conned you good and now you can't bear to admit you've been had. He's done it before. He does it to everyone. The man is certifiably insane. He was in Camarillo for years until Reagan became governor. Remember that? He cut the state budget and turned them all out in the streets. Aubrey Danziger came home at that point, and my life has been hell ever since.
I picked up a pencil and tapped on the edge of the desk, then tossed it aside. I'll tell you the truth. I want to find Elaine. That's all I want to do. I'm like a terrier pup. Somebody tells me to do something and it gets done. I'll worry the damn thing to death. I'm going to find out what happened to her and where she's been all these months. And you better hope it doesn't lead back to you.
She got up. She picked up her bag and leaned on my desk. And you better hope it doesn't lead back to Aubrey, my dear, she spat.
And then she was gone, leaving behind her the faint aura of whiskey that I'd just caught on her breath. I hauled out my typewriter and wrote a detailed report for Julia, itemizing expenses for the last couple of days. I needed to assimilate what Beverly had told me about Aubrey. It was like the paradox of the jungle tribes, where one always lies and the other always tells the truth. How could one ever determine which was which? Aubrey had told me Beverly was Mr. Hyde when she drank. She had told me he was certifiably mad, but she'd apparently been drinking when she said so. I hadn't the faintest idea which of them was on the level, and I wasn't sure how to find out. I didn't even know if it mattered. Was Elaine Bolt really dead? It had certainly crossed my mind more than once, but I hadn't imagined that Beverly or Aubrey might be at the heart of it. I'd been looking in the opposite direction, assuming somehow that Elaine's disappearance was linked to the murder of Marty Grice. Now I'd have to go back and take another look. I went home at lunchtime and did a run. I knew I was just treading water at this point, but in some ways I had to wait it out. Something would break. Some piece of information would come to light. In the meantime, I was feeling tense, and I needed to work that off. The run was a bad one, and that put me in a foul mood. I picked up a stitch in my side at the end of the first mile. I thought I could shake it. I tried digging my fingers in, bending at the waist, thinking that if it was a muscle cramp, it might ease. No deal. Then I tried expelling breath after breath, again bending from the waist. The pain was no worse, but it didn't go away either. Finally, I slowed to a walk until it subsided. But the minute I started to jog again, my side seized up, stopping me in my tracks. I'd reached the turnaround by then, but running seemed futile, so I walked the entire mile and a half back to my place, cursing to myself. I hadn't even broken a sweat, and my frustration, instead of dissipating, had doubled. I showered and dressed again. I didn't want to go back to the office, but I forced myself. I was going to have to start all over again, go back to the beginning and cast a new set of lines in the water to see if I could get a bite somewhere. I had just about used up my whole bag of tricks, but there had to be something else. When I let myself into the office, I saw the message light blinking on my machine. I opened the French doors to let some air in and then punched playback.
Hi, Kinsey. This is Lupe over at Santa Teresa Travel. It looks like you hit the jackpot on that luggage trace. I put a call through to baggage claim at TWA and had the agent check it out. The four bags were sitting right there. He said he could put them on a plane this afternoon if you like. Could you call me back and let me know what you want to do?
I snapped the machine off and shook both fists in the air, mouthing, "All right," to myself with a big grin. I put a call through to Jonah first and told him what was going on. I was jazzed. It was the first good news I'd had since I tracked down the cat.
What should I do, Jonah? Am I going to need some kind of court order to open those bags?
Screw that. Look, you have the claim tags, don't you?
Sure, I've got them right here.
Then go down to Florida and pick up the bags.
Why not just have them flown out?
Suppose she's in one, he said.
That certainly conjured up an image I didn't like. I could feel myself squirm. Don't you think someone would have noticed by now? You know, an odor, something dripping out the side?
Hey, we found a body once had been in the trunk of a car for 6 months. Someone had shoved a high heel down some whore's throat, and she ended up mummified. Don't ask me how or why, but she didn't decompose at all. She just dried up. She looked like a big leather doll.
Maybe I'll get on a plane, I said. By 10 o'clock that night, I was back in the air again. Chapter 19. It was drizzling, and the temperature was already in the 70s at 4:56 a.m. Eastern Standard Time when we touched down. It was still dark outside, but the airport was filled with the flat light and artificial chill of a space station orbiting 110 miles out. Dawn travelers walked purposefully down deserted corridors while doors shushed open and shut automatically, and the paging system seemed to drone on and on without hope of response. For all I knew, the whole operation was mechanical, running itself at that hour without any help from humankind. The TWA baggage service office didn't open until 9, so I had time to kill. I hadn't brought any luggage of my own. Just a big canvas bag where I kept a toothbrush and all the odds and ends of ordinary life, including clean underpants. I never go anywhere without a toothbrush and clean underpants. I went into the women's room to freshen up. I washed my face and ran my wet fingers through my hair, noting how sallow my skin looked with the fluorescent lights overhead. There was a woman behind me, changing the diaper on one of those oversized babies who looks like a solemn adult with flushed cheeks. The child kept his eyes pinned on me gravely while his mother attended to him. Sometimes cats look at me that way, as though we're foreign agents sending silent signals to one another in an out-of-the-way meeting place. I paused at a stand and picked up a newspaper. There was a coffee shop open, and I bought scrambled eggs, bacon, toast, and juice, taking my time about breakfast while I read a human interest story about a man who'd left all his money to a mina bird. I can't cope with the front section before 7 a.m.
At 8:45, having walked the airport from end to end twice, I stationed myself near baggage claim with a portable cart I'd rented for a buck. I could see Elaine's bags, neatly lined up at one end of the locked, glass-fronted cabinets. It looked as if someone had hauled them out from the bottom of the pile in readiness. Finally, a middle-aged man in a TWA uniform with a big set of jangling keys unlocked the small cubicle and started turning on lights. It looked like the opening curtain of a one-act play with a modest set. I presented myself and the baggage claim tags, and then followed him out to the storage cabinets and waited while he extracted the suitcases and stacked them on the cart. I expected him to ask for identification, but apparently he didn't care who I was. Maybe abandoned bags are like litters of unwanted kittens. He was just grateful to have someone take them off his hands. When the penny car rental desk opened, I rented a compact car. I had given Julia a call the night before, so she knew I was flying in. All I needed to do now was find the highway again and drive north. Once outside, I pushed the cart toward the slot where the rental car was parked. The drizzle settled on my skin like a layer of silk. The morning air was hot and close, smelling of rain and jet exhaust. I loaded the bags in the trunk of the car and headed toward Boca. It wasn't until I reached the condominium parking lot, unloading the suitcases one by one, that I realized all four were locked, and I had no key. Well, how very cute. Maybe Julia would have a plan. I lugged them over to the elevator and went up to the third floor, hauling them to Julia's front door in two trips. I knocked and waited a long interval while Julia thumped her way to the front door with her cane, calling encouragement.
I'm coming. Don't give up. 6 more feet to go, and I'm bearing down hard.
On my side of the door, I smiled, peering over at Elaine's apartment. There was no sign of life. Even the welcome mat had been taken inside or thrown out, leaving a square of fine sand that filtered through the bristles. Julia's door opened. The dowager's hump sat between her shoulder blades like a weight, forcing her to bend with its burden. She seemed to be staring at my waist, tilting her head of dandelion fuzz to one side so she could peer up at me. Her skin seemed as sheer as rubber, pulled over her hands like surgical gloves. I could see veins and broken capillaries, her knuckles as knotted as rope. Age was making her transparent, crushing her from both ends like a can of soda pop.
Well, Kinsey, I knew that was you. I've been awake since 6 this morning looking forward to this. Come on in.
She hobbled to one side, making way for me. I set the 4 suitcases inside the door and closed it after me. She tapped one with her cane.
I recognize those.
Unfortunately, they're locked. Each of the 4 bags apparently had a combination lock, the numbers arranged on a dial embedded in the metal catch.
We'll have to do some detective work, she said with satisfaction.